Investors Chronicle.
Hello and welcome back to the IC Interviews. I'm very sorry that we didn't publish a podcast last week, but we're more than making up for it this week with today's guest, Ian McCombie, manager of Baillie Gifford UK Growth Trust and lead manager of Baillie Gifford's UK Core Strategy. Ian is also a manager on a number of global funds and became a partner at Baillie Gifford in 2005. Ian, thank you for joining me. How are you?
Fine, thanks, Mary.
Well, I've been wanting to interview for ages because you've got such an interesting background for our readers and listeners, being a global manager with a UK focus. So to start us off, how do you feel about the opportunity among UK growth stocks and how does it compare with what you can find in other geographies?
Well, I think as a UK investor, I think there are plenty of growth opportunities. And I think there's a kind of myth that somehow you can't find interesting kind of companies in the UK. And what we're trying to do is find about 45 or so kind of names and from a universe of over 500. So we are being quite picky in what we're looking for, but I think you can find plenty of companies in the UK. Obviously, globally, if you're looking at it from a global perspective, there are more companies to pick from. Obviously, there's just it's a bigger universe. But you know what we have in the UK and in the Baillie Gifford UK equity team is very experienced people who know the market really well. So what we're partly trying to do is to find companies at that early growth stage, which I think is usually very lucrative for investors.
Yeah, and what are the key metrics that you're looking for when trying to find a UK growth company?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, Mary. I mean, it's the opportunity. What is the opportunity that you can see that business doing? And where could that business be in 5 or 10 years' time? You know, do the management have that vision, that ambition to grow the business? And these are really, really important kind of questions you've got to ask yourself. And it's not about what's going to happen in the next 6 months or the next year. It's where's that business going to be in 5 or 10 years' time? And can it finance that? These are the kind of key things that we're trying to look at.
Great. Well, I'm going to ask you more specifically about individual companies later on. But before we get there, I think a criticism of the UK stock market is that it's not competitive enough. And we had the Hill Review, which suggested a number of changes, some of which have been implemented. Some of them were allowing dual class share structures, for example, a premium listing so they could be included in indices. How do you feel about the regulations around the UK stock market? And do you think it should be made more competitive? Or some people worry that this might lead to slacker governance standards.
Yeah, it's an interesting kind of area to talk about, Mary. I mean, I think on the regulatory side, you've got to be very careful about saying, you know, that having, for example, you know, non-voting shares is always a good thing. I think in some circumstances, we can see that globally, it's been a great thing for companies to think long-term. And I think that's really the key point is the business being run on a long-term basis? And if sometimes, these types of class of shares helps companies to do that, I think that's a good thing. But obviously you can think of perhaps, you know, a more, you know, example in the UK market at the moment where there's a kind of a controversy around, you know, that the Hutt Group where that's not kind of worked out so well. And I think it's the old story, isn't it, Mary, that it works until it doesn't. And I think that these are the things you've got to be careful about. But what we do at Baillie Gifford is try to look at it on an individual basis. You know, so it's not saying, you know, you start off with a prejudice that this is a good or a bad thing. It's let's look at this individual company. Let's look at the management, the board and so on. What are they trying to do? And sometimes we're very happy globally to back companies with, you know, different class voting shares. And other times we're just not comfortable. And it's nothing to do with the principle. It's more just the individual company and the people that are running it.
Yeah, that makes sense. So you don't feel like because of the UK structure, you're maybe missing out on opportunities that might otherwise be here?
I mean, I think the thing that's clear is the UK has lacked a lot of technology businesses that have, you know, other markets like the US in particular have a large and thriving market. And frankly, we haven't helped ourselves, you know, like things like Arm Holdings, which was a great British success story. And too many shareholders sold out when the board kind of lost confidence and decided to sell out to SoftBank. We voted against that. We were the biggest shareholder. We thought that was a terrible decision because, you know, but what people were worried about was the short term because they'd have to reinvest in the business to keep growing for the long term. And some people said, well, that's not very good. You know, profits are going to go down the next 3 years. But if you're thinking 10 years, that's what they had to do. And the fact that even under SoftBank, it doesn't look as they have done that and they've lost a lot of ground to other players, which is a real shame.
Yeah. Now, I know you are long-term investors, as you say, but inflation is something that a lot of investors are worried about at the moment. It feels like policymakers will be happy to let it run for a while. This affects companies in lots of different ways, with rising input prices, rising energy prices, rising staffing costs. How do you think about inflation, and has it affected any of your investment decisions?
I mean, the short answer is no. But you're absolutely right to focus, actually, when you talked about management, how do they juggle it? And I think that's really, I always think it's the factor that's not on share prices that I think investors are really going to think about is the management team. How are they handling these issues that you rightly kind of you point out? And I think a good management team doesn't necessarily always can solve every problem, but it can anticipate problems and start to manage them. And I don't think, everyone's talking about inflation at the moment. I think rightly so, because it hasn't been an issue for a while. But other times people will be talking to me about currency, the pound being weak or strong, and how does that impact a business? The reality, I think, is that businesses are always having to juggle these things. And really what you're trying to do is to see, well, does the company have pricing power or not? And probably for a lot of businesses, they haven't had to worry about that for a long time. Now we're starting to see that kind of coming through. And, take an example, a company called Volution, which is one of our bigger holdings in the fund. It makes kind of fans and clean air solutions. I think they put through 3 price increases in the UK so far in the last 12 months to kind of combat, some of the input prices, and they've all stuck. Now that's a kind of a good sign for business that, the client, the customers really value that product. And the fact that they're going to have to just pay for it. Now, what I'm trying to say to them is, we had a meeting with them recently, is, look, it's not just about, the short term. What about the long term? Couldn't you be using this as a competitive advantage? Because actually, it's not just about pricing, Mary. It's also something about availability of product. As we all know, there are supply chain issues. Actually, they have a manufacturing base in Reading. They're actually able to supply their customers. Some of the people who've been importing from China are not. Now, that's a great long-term kind of growth story. So, and they're being smart about that. They're not just saying we can charge as high, much as we want at the moment. It's about how do we grow our market share long-term.
That's interesting. And do you think because you were looking for these long-term quality companies that maybe they're the types of companies that would be more resilient than other parts of the market?
Well, I mean, it's horses to fortune, isn't it, by saying that your business are always more resilient than others. You'd always hope on a portfolio sense that would be true. There are always going to be some businesses that are going to have some challenges within that. But I think to me, if you're running the business for the long term, you will manage your way through these issues. And what we're certainly trying to avoid are businesses where there isn't much pricing power, or you're very much vulnerable to these things. We're trying to weed these kind of businesses out in our business analysis when we're trying to invest in companies. Because as you said earlier, Mary, our portfolio turnover is very low. It's sort of 5%, type thing. So, we try and hold companies for a long period of time. And that's why we think, the quality of the business, the quality of the management, the quality of the growth opportunity are so important to talk about.
Do you feel Baillie Gifford's got a very distinct company style for long-term growth? Do you feel that pushes you in a certain direction, or do you feel like you can do what you want investment-wise?
Well, I mean, we are growth investors, and therefore what it means is there's large chunks of the market you just don't spend much time on because we just don't see the growth opportunity there. So we're not trying to say we cover the whole market. We could hire lots and lots of people to be very, frankly, run around looking at companies that are of interest to us. Why would we do that? What we're trying to do is focus our time on areas which are interesting. But, still within that, there's a lot of businesses we just turn down. We just don't look. We do the analysis and we can't convince ourselves that they're good enough to kind of, sell something to fund that. So that's a kind of that competition for capital type of thing. So we're always looking for new ideas, but we don't always, take it up on that. And the fact that our portfolio turnover is so low, my co-manager Milena will kind of tease me by saying, we're trying to stir up apathy at times because, actually sometimes what you own in your portfolio is far more interesting than something that looks new, it's shiny, it's different, but it may not be necessarily as good as what you've got already.
In this sort of long-term vein, a number of Baillie Gifford funds have been moving more into private companies among the investment trusts. Baillie Gifford UK Growth Trust can invest up to 10% in private companies. It looks to me like there are none in your portfolio, or at the time of your annual report at least. How do you see the relative attractiveness of private and public companies in the UK?
Yeah, well, you're correct. We don't have anything at the moment, but we only got permission earlier this year to actually invest in private companies. So it's still for us and the trust, it's very early days in that process. We've actually looked at one or two ideas yet, but nothing has kind of quite crossed the line yet. But, you know, watch this space, I suppose, would be the thing. But what we're kind of trying to see, and what other trusts at Baillie Gifford have seen, is the fact that there are some very interesting businesses that potentially are coming to the market a bit later than they traditionally would have done when they float, and potentially you can invest in these companies at an early stage. But just to be clear, what we've always said for shareholders is that we don't see private as being different. What we're trying to find is the same types of businesses we're already investing in. So we're not suddenly going to lurch into, you know, early stage, you know, sort of highly speculative businesses. We're trying to find businesses we think have got, this happens not to be quoted, but they have still that same kind of growth potential in them.
Were you tempted to follow Scottish Mortgage into blockchain.com, which is the UK's biggest cryptocurrency company, which they invested in earlier this year?
Well, we didn't have the opportunity at that point, so, you know, we'll never know, I suppose. But equally, I mean, I think there's other benefits that we've seen from Baillie Gifford having made these relationships. So, for example, we took part in the when Wise came to the market, you know, the foreign exchange kind of business. Now, our private companies team had owned that for a number of years. They knew the company really well. I'd actually met them when they were still unquoted. So the fact that we'd built up quite a lot of knowledge about it gave us that confidence when it came to the market that we knew what this business was about and the track record. And therefore, we were able to kind of get comfortable to buy it. Because that's the thing I think it's always important to know, Mary, is when you're an IPO, often when you take part in it, you don't really have much information. And it's all very much at the last minute. You're on a roadshow and so on. Whereas the benefit of having the private companies team is we knew this business quite well before we kind of decided to invest in it, which I think was an advantage.
Are there any other IPOs you participated in recently?
Yeah, there's a couple actually. One is Oxford Nanopore, which is another kind of, you know, really interesting kind of UK kind of technology business, which I'm sure a lot of people have heard of. It kind of competes with Illumina in terms of the kind of gene sequencing equipment. But there's another one which I suspect most people haven't heard of. It's a company called Exscientia. Now, it's actually quoted in the US, but it's a British biotech business or healthcare business. And what it does is it uses AI to help drug discovery. And their insight is that they think that, you know, a lot of R&D by the big pharma companies is actually not very efficient. Whereas what they're trying to use artificial intelligence and systems to try and target much more. So that's a really interesting kind of area. It's an early stage business in some respects, but they've got some really strong kind of backing from people like Bristol-Myers Squibb, Sanofi, Bayer, companies that have you know, partnered with Exscientia on individual drugs. So it's kind of interesting that we think this is an area that, you know, healthcare is, you know, which is not a new insight, there's a lot of money spent there. It's not done very efficiently. And a company like this could help that be done more efficiently, which I think is really exciting. And potentially they take a share of that, which could be very exciting.
So that's examples of some companies you bought recently. What are the companies that you've sold most recently?
We've only sold two. One was a company called James Fisher. It was a small holding, which we just decided actually that the growth story wasn't really panning out as we'd hoped. So we just said, well, actually, we've got better things to invest in. So we sold it. The other one we sold out to was Ultra Electronics, which actually, you know, has been subject to a bid. So the share price has gone up a lot. We thought there was a kind of risk that this could get blocked in some respects. So we decided to take our profits, substantial profits, and sell it elsewhere. But that's all we've done there. But, you know, again, the context, all these things that we're talking about, you know, portfolio turnover is certainly less than 10%. So we're not doing a lot of trading. So I always think what we own is probably more important than all this kind of interesting stuff that we're talking about at the moment.
Yeah, conviction in your ideas.
Exactly.
So on that theme, it's interesting that financials is such a large chunk of the portfolio. Mm-hmm. Why are you so keen on this sector, brokerage services in particular?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a couple of things, Mary. I mean, one is that, for example, we don't own banks. So it's not as we like all financials. Actually, we're looking for businesses we've got great growth potential. And actually, I think the UK has got a number of really terrific businesses. The wealth platforms, we own Hargreaves Lansdown, a company called Integrafin that owns Transact, AJ Bell. So all these businesses, I think, are doing really well. You know, there's a definite demand for savings. And it makes a lot of sense to have it on a platform. And, you know, they are all doing different business models. Again, that's, somebody said, well, why do you own all three? Well, I said, they're all trying to do something slightly different, but it's not mutually exclusive. We think they're all winners, but they're just targeting the markets in different ways, which I think is exciting. But we also like insurance or life insurance. We think, again, that's a really interesting area. We've got Prudential, which has got this terrific business in Asia. But we've also got things like Legal & General, which I think is doing a really interesting job in the UK. It's a tremendous investor in a lot of these really interesting areas that we're crying out for in taking these long-term investments. So actually, it's got a very interesting kind of business angle. And you've got a business like St. James's Place, which I guess is a bit controversial to some people. But if you look at its growth, it's been one of the great success stories in the UK.
Yeah, St. James's Place comes under criticism for having quite high fees and poor fund performance. I think I remember there was a report by research firm Yodler earlier this year saying that 8 out of 10 SJP funds have consistently underperformed. How do you see the sort of long-term outlook for the company against this backdrop?
Yeah, well, I think the thing about costs is that, and that's always the thing that all investors should be worrying about with all these types of businesses. But I think the thing that you're trying to compare, what are you comparing? Is it like for like? Because what St. James's Place client is getting is advice. And that's very different to, say, a DIY investor that's using a platform that's, you know, has no advisor and is looking for a kind of cheap fees. By definition, they're bound to probably have lower costs than somebody like a St. James's Place, where the advice is kind of bundled into that. So it's what you want. And what the St. James's Place product is trying to do is for people who need advice, who are probably not wanting to spend a lot of time thinking about it, they've got an advisor to do that for them. And they pay for that. Now, some of that cost is bundled up into these fees, which is not the case with some of these others. So yes, it looks expensive relative to that, and sometimes that can mean that the fund is underperformed. But remember, the customer is paying for advice, and because this is a regulated industry, where if you haven't done this properly and you haven't got the paperwork, the regulators will do these periodic inspections of that. You can't do that for nothing, and I think that the problem, actually, as we all know, is or certainly those of us in the financial industry or who could comment on it, is getting ever more complicated. And particularly for things like pensions and so on, if you don't know what you're doing, you can potentially get into some quite expensive tax penalties if you haven't been doing that. So people need advice. The problem for this country is we don't have enough advisors. So actually, St. James's Place, I think, is part of the solution, not a problem. We need more advisors rather than less advisors, because, you know, frankly, there's so many minefields now that clients or prospective clients need to be kind of helped through. Because, and sadly, you and I are probably the worst people. We're interested in this area, but a lot of people are more sensible, have got outside the interests who they don't want to worry about this stuff. So it's almost at that point about, you know, remember who's a client. Who's a client being targeted here? It's very different to, say, you and I, who can probably do these things. It's that advice thing. I don't know if that makes sense at all.
That makes absolute sense. Yes, we need more advisors. We also need more people to take out Investors Chronicle subscriptions to help make their investment decisions. On Hargreaves Lansdown, mm-hmm. You've got Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ Bell. Your position in Hargreaves Lansdown is bigger. Do you think it, because it's got of the DIY platform market, and it is quite a bit more expensive on its funds, and you've got Interactive Investor, which has a flat fee model, which could be, do you think Hargreaves Lansdown will be able to retain its position given its it is a bit more expensive and these flat fee rivals are coming through?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think what they would say is if you just look at it purely on price, you're not looking at value. And it's the same thing with St. James's Place. It's you pay sometimes what you get for, and some of these other services might be cheaper, but do they have the same levels of service or the variety of products that you can get? What is interesting about Hargreaves, and I'm sure some of the other players like AJ Bell would say, well, you know, but we're still, we're cheaper. But what's interesting in both is they're both still growing. And that's what I said to you earlier, Mary, that it's not a mutually exclusive. It's not a kind of, you know, one wins, one loses. They're actually both winning. And what Hargreaves, I think, is remarkable is old people have been worried about this pricing thing for a while, that they're not the cheapest in the market. They continue to take market share. So that's the kind of the interesting thing. And therefore, to me, it would argue that it's not just about price. It's about other kind of, you know, is it trust to the brand? Is it about the quality of the service that they're getting from that? You know, the ease of actually being able to speak to people on the help desk when you've got a problem. There are things like that I think people think about on just the security of it. Do you want to put your life savings in a platform you've never heard of? And, you know, what happens if something went wrong? You know, Hargreaves is a FTSE 100 company. It's a very strong financial business. You know, there are a lot of different factors, which I think it's not just about price. Otherwise, I think, you know, market shares wouldn't be where they are.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with that. And you see surveys time and again saying that people care more about how easy it is to use than they do about price. Another company, which I think is a fantastic company, is measuring device maker Renishaw. Mm-hmm. Earlier this year, it announced that it wanted to take itself private. That hasn't happened. What's your outlook for Renishaw from here?
Yeah, well, I mean, the backdrop was that the two founders of Renishaw, who are, you know, getting on a bit, decided they thought they should sell the business, but they couldn't because they wanted to attach conditions to whoever bought the business, and also ultimately they couldn't agree terms with any of the buyers. But in a funny way, you know, fundamentally, this is a brilliant business in the UK. It's a brilliant UK business. It's invested in technology. It spends a huge amount of its turnover on R&D, you know, much more than most engineering businesses. I think it's in the mid-teens, something like that, which compared to most industrial businesses is a lot more. But then they continue to be innovative. And what is interesting is that we spoke to the chief executive after the process had fallen through, and he said, well, actually the really interesting thing from his perspective, he's not one of the founders, is that it actually validated a lot of what they're doing in terms of what the potential people were interested in. Is like, these are the areas that they're investing in, these are the products that they're starting to bring out. So there's still obviously a kind of uncertainty what's going to happen longer term. In one sense, I'm not unhappy, if I'm honest, Mary, because actually it's a unique business. It happens to be British. I'm very happy it's still quoted on the UK. I was almost a bit more upset that we're going to lose that business. So in one sense, you know, yes, the share price went down when the thing fell through, but actually from a long-term perspective, to own a business which is in a lot of potential really exciting growth opportunities, it's not a bad thing. We're just going to have to see what happens with the founders, what they're going to go off and do. But again, long-term, you know, my view is let them think about it and reflect about it. They've always treated the minority shareholders very well, so I've got no concerns on that front. But we'll see. But you know, I would love it if it could still remain a UK quoted business, because it is such a unique growth opportunity that's had, and what they've done, what they've created here. It's a business people should be really proud of.
And another interesting company, which I think is currently your top holding, is Genus, mm-hmm. which is an animal genetics company aiming to help farmers breed better pigs and cattle so they can make better meat and milk. I've heard analysts say that it's a tricky company to understand and value. Can you tell us about this company and the investment case?
Yeah, well, I think you summed it up really well, so I'm not going to try and top that, because I think you've got the real essence there. What I think I would add to it is the fact that it's what is a problem? A lot of the problem is in a lot of emerging markets, and is that people want, as they get wealthier, they want to eat better. And the problem, therefore, for a lot of countries is, well, how do I make my farming more efficient? Because a lot of countries like China, traditionally, like pigs, which are an important part of the diet and a growing part of the diet, it wasn't done bluntly on an industrial scale. It was all done in little small holdings. And you're also prone to kind of diseases breaking out because people weren't looking at it very, very, you know, a little farmer is not kind of probably going to take as much care about it as a kind of a much more industrial concern. So a lot of policy makers around the world have been saying, look, we've got to kind of do this more scientifically in a sense. And this is where something like Genus comes in, because they've got the technology to allow kind of, you know, pig breeding, for example, to be done better. So actually for the farmers, they have a much better idea what the type of pigs that they're going to get. The quality of the pig is going to be better, and therefore they get better yields for it. So there's a lot of reasons why this makes sense. The problem, as you highlighted, is for people to start to understand, well, how do I value that? Because there's really no other business like this in the world. There's smaller kind of farmer cooperatives in Denmark and so on that are trying to compete, but they're much smaller than Genus. But what we're trying to do is to look at the growth, the opportunity that could be there. And it's saying, well, what happens if people in China want to eat more pork and better pork? You know, how's that going to happen? Well, this is where Genus really kind of comes in. And it's not just in emerging markets, also in developed markets. If people want to eat better, they might eat less meat, you know, because people worry about, well, we're going to eat less meat. But they might, but they probably want to eat better meat when they do. So therefore, again, Genus is probably part of this potential solution to that. So we're trying to think that long-term view rather than seeing the short-term, well, it looks very expensive. It's, what is the alternative here? What's the long-term trend here? And we think the long-term trends are a tailwind for Genus. So that's why we continue to have a big holding in it.
In terms of the long-term, what's the long-term growth opportunity for Rightmove, which is another one of your top 10 holdings? Because I might question if it's, you know, how saturated the market is and how much it correlates with house prices, the value of
money. Yeah, well, I mean, it's interesting. If you look at the business and how it's operated against people worry about the housing market, there's much smaller correlation than you might think. And that kind of gets back to the point of it's become a must-have product. You know, various competitors have tried to come in and people have been a bit worried about it. I mean, Google tried to get into it. There's been one or two smaller businesses that have tried to compete against it, but they've not been able to kind of compete successfully against it. You know, it is the dominant player. If you want to sell your house, you have to have it on Rightmove, because that's where you're going to get the most people are going to look at it. So actually, although people like the estate agents don't like Rightmove, and the irony is actually Rightmove was founded by an estate agent. And then they sold it off, which is probably not the cleverest thing they could have probably done. But you know, that's the thing. But the thing is, it's a must-have product. So actually, what we like about it is the fact that they've always stayed very focused. They didn't try and take over the world. They just, let's become the dominant player in the UK. Let's keep adding new services to it to make it better and better. And we've got some pricing power, because the estate agents, whether they like it or not, they need it. And other people have come in, tried to compete against it, but ultimately, I think it was On the Market tried to do that and said, well, you can only use us or one other player. Well, actually, what it turned out was that everyone certainly wanted to keep on Rightmove. You know, why'd you turn off the dominant player in the market? So I still see it as a kind of, it's a very interesting business, very high margin, very, very, very profitable. But remember, they also, I think, behaved responsibly during the pandemic. That they gave holidays and discounts to estate agents. They recognize the fact, look, the market's kind of closed for a period. The customers are really struggling here. So they kind of they gave big discounts to the price. Short term, that hits profits. But I think the long term, that's the right thing to do, because you know, you still need your estate agents there to be selling the product. So I think it's a funny relationship. I'm sure, as I say, you know, estate agents don't like them, but actually the fact they didn't exploit them when they were at the most vulnerable, because they took the long-term view of, we need these people, we need these guys selling houses ultimately, but you still need Rightmove. And that's why we like it.
Okay. So you don't think they'll have to move out of property to be able to continue to grow?
I don't think so. I mean, they looked at things like they've been in things like rentals and things like that. But I think the thing is, it's more, sometimes it's about focusing on what do people want and what are the additional services we can do. So it's things like, you know, giving stuff about the schools and the area and catchment areas, information that for a lot of people, it really matters where you're going to buy that house. You know, two streets along, that's a big difference because it's a different catchment area, different school and things like that. So it's things like that, trying to understand what your customers want, which is a really important thing. I think if you're too busy trying to conquer the world and you're not really focusing on what your customers want, potentially you can lose that business. And that's why I think they've been very good, is because they've always focused on it. I think they're paranoid about that. They don't want to lose that dominant position. So they're always looking for innovation to kind of keep driving that business on.
And another portfolio company, which has come under quite a bit of scrutiny, is Boohoo.com. Mm-hmm. So it's been criticised for having poor working conditions in its supply chain and in its factories in Leicester. So far this year, the share price is down over 40%. What's your outlook for the future of Boohoo.com?
Yeah, I mean, the first thing I would say is it's a bit like, you know, it's a great British success story. You know, if we step back and say, look, this is a very entrepreneurial business that started with nothing and it's grown into quite a large business, you know, rather than every kind of lines up to criticize it, we should be saying, look, this is the type of entrepreneurial business we need in this country that is actually globally doing really quite well. That, you know, whether, you know, we can all talk about, you know, what politicians want, but actually we need businesses like that to thrive. So that's my first point, that let's give them a lot of credit for what they've done. You're right, though, that they've had challenges. You know, this is the problem with growing very quickly, is you kind of have these growing pains. And it's been very public, but some of the supply chain issues in Leicester in particular are not good. And that's something we've been engaging with the company about, saying, look, we really feel you've got to deal with this because it could become a real problem for you and it could really impact your long-term growth story. So what we've been encouraged by is the fact that they do seem to address it. They've got an independent Levinson to kind of come in to kind of look at it and to see audit it and say, well, are they making progress? Now, that's happening. So that I think that's we're not out of the woods yet, but they're certainly kind of encouraging signs. I think the other thing that's been going on, which has nothing to do with these ESG issues, is really the supply chain issues that, you know, I kind of referenced that earlier. And they have been impacted a bit by that in the short term. So that's kind of had some kind of cost points, but the fact is that they're still growing 20-25%. You know, most businesses would kind of kill to have kind of growth rates like that. And where some people say, well, that's a bit disappointing. You think, well, hold on a second. This is not a disaster here. But that's the kind of things that we're kind of the kind of push pull. And then there's obviously the Chinese, kind of online business that people are competing against, which are worried about, you know, is this going to be a problem? It might be. But then again, it goes back to this point about why has this business been so successful? It's because it's got that entrepreneurial drive. It's hired also a very good chief executive and then top, you know, used to, you know, run Primark. So these are not fools that are running this business by any means. These are very smart people, very entrepreneurial, very competitive people. I'm not, you know, never say never, but if there's any business I think it can adapt to these challenging conditions, I think it would be Boohoo. They're not the smoothest in kind of the PR, but that's because they're just learning this. But I'd rather invest in a business that's, you know, not perfect, but it's got that opportunity and is willing to learn and get better at it. You know, and so that's why we still remain holders of it.
Great. They certainly have managed to produce products that people want to buy. Also in the retail space, sort of perhaps at the other end of the spectrum, I think you've bought M&S, I think, in your managed fund. I'm not sure if it's in the UK Growth Trust. It certainly timed its deal with Ocado very well last yes. year. But why are you backing M&S?
Yeah, well, it's not owned in the trust at the moment, but it's one that we're thinking about. But yeah, it's an interesting one. I mean, we haven't owned M&S for probably at least 25 years. In Baillie Gifford. So we really have to go back a long time before we've owned it. And the reason was, you know, for obvious reasons, it wasn't a growth business. You know, it had a dominant market share in the UK and it's kind of just, it's been eroded over time. Various management teams have kind of come in and basically tried to turn it around and, you know, it hasn't really worked. So what's changed? Well, the one thing we always thought was they'd a very good food business. But they lack that distribution. And as you said, Mary, they've done that joint venture with Ocado in the UK, which is really kind of, you know, basically lined up with the best technology business in that area, in the world, probably. So that's a great kind of growth opportunity for them. And as you say, you know, the timing, that's luck. You know, nobody saw the pandemic. But the thing that we've, for our other funds where we've started to take a position in it is, well, what we were worried about the rest of the business was the clothing and so on. You know, is there any value in that? Is it basically just a terrible business that's going to go X growth and it's just declining? And we're now starting to say, well, actually, maybe it's not quite as, you know, there might be a growth story here. That actually they've used this pandemic to really reset the business and get it back into, you know, despite the fact that everybody pretends that they've never shopped at M&S, you know, they sell more jeans in the UK than anyone else. You know, and various kind of categories, they are still the biggest player in the UK. So actually, despite the fact that they haven't done something a very good job, there's a fantastically loyal customer base there. But actually, I think they've been revamping it. And actually, you know, dare I say it, people are starting to shop at M&S again. Not, you know, and that's a good thing. So actually, I think this business might be turning around. And it's a very much a might, because we've been here before and it hasn't worked. But what I think is different is the fact that I think management are very cognitive of the problems, and they're starting to deal with some of the kind of the poor shops that they've had. You know, the fact that one of the problems is they're locked into some quite expensive leases with some kind of pretty shabby businesses, you know, shabby shops. And they say, well, why do we keep, you know, let's run them for cash. Now, in the short term, if you're a bean counter, that makes sense. But honestly, Mary, if you go into one or two of those shops, they look awful because they're not putting any money into them. And it really damages the brand. And I think the new management team get that now, that that's short term, that may be painful. But actually, if we don't move these shops or, you know, or do something about them, that's what damages the business, because people say, oh, it's really awful. But then if you go into one of the new stores that they've been in, I don't know, Mary, you've done that, they're actually pretty good. They're actually pretty impressive. Now, I'm not just that. My wife kind of came in and said, that's actually not bad, actually. So, you know, it's things like that. So it's not just, so I think there's a perception thing there that might be changing.
Interesting. Well, I'll have to go down and have a look. I know that my mum's definitely a loyal M&S customer. sorry, we're getting close to the end, but just a couple more questions. Draper Esprit, the European tech-focused VC, has done very well this year, which might then naturally lead to questions about valuations. How do you feel about the coming years for Draper Esprit?
Yeah, well, they kind of just issued a trading update last week, which was actually better than expected. So the portfolio is performing very well. So the share price is about just over about 10% higher than the net asset value at the end of September. So I don't think it's an excessive valuation. The company's got net cash on its balance sheet, about 150 million, something like that. So it's got opportunities to invest. Now, the thing why we like it, Draper, is the fact that they have this opportunity to invest in these private earlier stage businesses. And despite the fact that people kind of assume like the UK and Europe is kind of like there's no technology businesses, actually there are. And they have been able to invest in a number of them at kind of quite early stages. And Draper is a kind of way to kind of play that game, as it were. And actually, to be fair to them, they've also been able to exit a number of businesses at quite good prices. So it's not, so they're recycling their capital back into kind of new areas, which is kind of interesting. But and it's not just in the UK, it's also in Europe. So it's there's a lot of interesting areas, and my colleagues and my European colleagues are kind of have been saying this for a while, that actually, you know, again, if you look at the cliche or Europe's a terrible place to invest, not true. There's actually some really interesting businesses there, and there's some very interesting kind of private unquoted businesses, and Draper allows us to invest in some of them. So that's why we continue to like it.
And final question, if you had to pick one company that you're most excited about in terms of what it's doing and capacity for growth, what company would it be and why?
Oh gosh, I almost struggle to say that, because I think there's so many businesses, and a number of the numbers we've talked about so far are all really interesting. I'll give you one that we haven't talked about, which is very different. It's a company called Naked Wines, which is it came out of ultimately Majestic Wines. You may remember that, but they sold the Majestic Wines, and what they focused on is the direct to consumer business. And what I think is really interesting about this business is it's disrupting the classic, you know, you go through a distributor. So actually, it's a great deal for the consumer who kind of signs up, they get good wine at a cheap price. but it's also great for the wine growers because they don't then have to pay through a middleman. So actually they keep more money as well. So actually what Naked Wines are doing is actually allowing both the kind of wine grower and the consumer to kind of get a good deal, which is an interesting kind of model. So it's different. It's still kind of, but also what's interesting is the fact that it's been successful in the US. So I'm sure you'll know as well as anyone, it's so difficult for many British businesses to crack the US. Early signs are that they're doing something really interesting there, because it's not for the kind of person that's wanting to buy a cheap bottle of Plonk in the supermarket. It's for people who are really interested in wine and the story and, you know, where's this wine come from and who are the growers and all this stuff. You know, you might be rolling your eyes at that, but some people really like that. And as you can imagine, in the US, there's lots of people who are really interested in that. So I think it's a really interesting kind of business model. It's one that, it's kind of pretty unique. And it's got a very entrepreneurial management team there that's trying to grow the long business for the long term. So they're investing now. So it's a classic business. It doesn't make any money at the moment, but I think they're storing up a lot of value for the future. So that's a kind of an interesting business I think is really exciting.
Yeah, I'm not rolling my eyes at all. I got a voucher with a big discount from them, which bought a case of wine and it helped me get through lockdown.
So. Oh, well, that's good. hopefully the wine was good. Was it good?
It was. It was very good. It was very good. It was sort of the price I would normally spend with my £75 discount. But much better quality than what I would normally drink. Anyway, Ian, thank you so much for your time. That's been really, really interesting. And I'm sure our listeners will greatly appreciate it. Thank you.
Good to chat. Thank you, Mary.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.